into the room. The Room is a series that lets you get a view into the room where it happened. I'm Claudia Laurie.
And I'm Madison McElwain, your co-host.
If you've paid attention to the Instagram posts of celebrities such as Angelina Jolie, Jessica Alba, and Lady Gaga, to name a few, you have probably seen fashion's newest it bag. Unlike others, this one doesn't come from a European fashion house established the prior century, but instead, it was born out of Silicon Valley just 4 years ago in typical startup fashion. Today's episode of The Room dives into Coral Chung's founding story of Synrev, a luxury handbag company designed for the multifaceted modern woman. Originally born in China, Coral's family immigrated to Southern California where she was a kid. After Stanford, experience in traditional fashion such as Prada and working at e-commerce tech startup Medallia, Coral realized the luxury fashion industry was ripe for disruption. Synrev, meaning sense and dream, uses tech startup theses around data, iteration, and smart manufacturing to make the perfect bag for the stylish professional woman. In this episode, we explore themes such as disrupting traditional industries such as retail, the power of data in understanding your customer, and international growth in times of uncertainty.
Thank you so much for sitting down with Madison and me today to discuss building Synrev, which is now an incredibly impressive global brand. Obviously, the bulk of our conversation is going to be diving into what it was like being in the room with you as you were building Synrev. But given that we're in quarantine, Madison and I are both in San Francisco right now, we thought it would be nice to open with asking.
So I am in my cabin, actually in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I have been here for a few months because the COVID situation is calmer here, and I have a little one, a seven-year-old, and she's able to do a lot of outdoors activities safely still. That's been a huge blessing for us.
That's incredible. Before we dive into really getting into the details of what it was like building Synrev, would love to just zoom out a little bit and give some of our listeners context on a bit of your background. Tell us what it was like coming from China, growing up in Southern California. How did your background inform your perspective as a founder?
It was a huge and formative experience being an immigrant at 4 years old, leaving my hometown in China and moving to California. And it's been a really incredible journey in a way, because I feel like that has always allowed me to be very bicultural in nature. So I'm really embracing my Chinese heritage, but also I think of myself as an American in so many ways. And I think being someone who is not knowing the language, someone who's adapting to a new culture, new environment, new school, friends, food, everything, I think it gives me a certain level of empathy, I would say, for people who are consumers or people who are experiencing things for the first time. And also, I think it really shaped my view of the world in terms of having a global mindset, and really was formative in how I thought of Synrev from day one as very much a global brand.
And we are really excited to touch on some of the global pieces of your recent growth strategy a little bit later. You landed at some pretty elite universities, UPenn, Stanford for Business School. Tell us, were you starting businesses and kind of prepping for being a founder while you were at school?
I think what's really interesting is I always had a very entrepreneurial bent, very creative focus. But in my business training and in my analytical upbringing, where my family really emphasized STEM, really emphasized math, really emphasized being on a track that was far from this creative or exploratory bent that I naturally had. So I kind of was meeting in the middle. I would say my undergrad experience was extremely rigorous. I focused on things that I wish I didn't focus on so much. And that was where the Stanford experience was really different. It was very much allowed me to, I would say, dive into my creative side, my entrepreneurial side, and really flex those muscles in a way that prior to going to Stanford for business school, I feel like it was there, but it was sort of untapped.
When you were at Stanford, you were part of a luxury retail club. And those looked like there were trips that took you all over the world.
Yes, I led something called the Lux Trek, which was a very formative experience, I would say, in terms of starting SendRev. It really started the early kind of sowed the seeds, if you will, for me starting SendRev eventually. But yes, it was a really incredible experience going to Paris and Milan and Florence and really meeting all the top luxury brands and meeting the executives there. And really for the first time in my mind, feeling that this was the type of business that I would want to start. This is the type of the business that I would want to build my career around. And I think it was really just inspiring in a huge way. And so I don't know if you guys have watched Emily in Paris. It's a little bit of a cheesy show, but it really just brought me back to 10 years ago. I had summer internship experience at a boutique investment bank in Paris. It was located on Avenue Montaigne. It was just the most incredible experience. But anyhow, the Stanford platform was so critical for me, and the Lux Trek was a huge crowning achievement, I would say, in a way, because it really changed a lot of things about my perspective.
And I think a key theme in the show is that this character, Emily, moves to Paris to help with the marketing firm and kind of bring the American spirit into France, which most French individuals are not super thrilled, but she's very inspired by what is there. And I think we can see that in SendRev and how you've brought in the magical elements of these luxury fashion houses, where you've brought just the kind of romantic nature of shopping. Touching back on your more business experience, right? You Penn undergrad, GSB, worked at Bain in between kind of both of these academic experiences, and then ultimately landed at Medallia, which is, for those who don't know, leading customer service tool for many large retailers, helping to facilitate real-time customer feedback. It had an incredibly successful IPO just last year and is now valued at over $4 billion. But you actually left there, right in the middle, this kind of rocket ship journey, so to speak, to found what is now SendRev. Walk us through what that decision and journey was like.
That was a really difficult decision, as you can imagine. I joined Medallia with this great anticipation for being part of a huge success of a growing company. And I joined actually at the time knowing that it was going to go public. And Doug Leone, who's a great mentor of mine, is on the board of Medallia, or was on the board of Medallia at the time, and really recruited me and told me, like assured me, like, this is a great asset. You know, you want to join this rocket ship, in his really convincing and persuasive way. So it was really hard for me to say no to that opportunity. I was leading retail there, which was a big growing segment for them, working with brands ranging from Apple to Nike to Sephora to Tory Burch to all the major retailers and leading brands globally. It was such an exciting time for the company. And I just, you know, I had a wonderful experience there. The team that I joined when I first joined was about 3 people, and it expanded to 30 by the time I left. So there were so many lessons learned from a company that was in, you know, ultra high growth mode that clearly was just on the cusp of going public. It's hard to leave an environment and an opportunity like that to start from scratch. So that took a huge leap of faith, and it took a lot of courage. And it also was the type of thing where I didn't want to feel any regrets, you know, no matter how SendRev turned out, knowing that Medallia was going to IPO, that I was walking away, leaving a lot of money on the table, and it was not the most rational decision. I also wanted to be comfortable with myself looking back and saying, hey, I have no regrets. I made the right decision during that time.
I've often gotten the advice that the hardest thing to do, but probably the best thing to do from a career perspective, is to leave at the top. It really seems like that is exactly what happened, and from one local maxima to maybe a global maxima.
My career was very much, you know, up and to the right, very structured, step by step. And I think when you get on that type of track, it's really, really hard to change your mindset, to think about your career and your life really in a much more adventurous and winding journey. It's usually not a straight line, and it shouldn't be a straight line, because that means you're taking too few risks and you're not getting all of the interesting experiences that one should be getting out of life. And so, yes, I felt like it was a sacrifice to walk away in many ways. And I had a lot of advisors and mentors and friends tell me, you're crazy. But ultimately, I feel that I did the right thing. And, you know, SendRev has been just tremendously successful and in a way exceeding my wildest expectations. In a way, not, because I did dream this up and always had a vision for it.
The incredible thing is, though, that you haven't done this alone. You've done it alongside your co-founder, Wendy Wen, who you met at Stanford. But when picking a co-founder, it can be a bit of an arduous process for individuals, because I've heard from others that it's almost a more intense relationship than your life partner. So I would love to double click into your experience meeting Wendy and how you chose to enter into this business endeavor together to build what is SendRev today, and really how you two have grown up together in this experience.
So I met Wendy through a friend. She was actually a few years after me at Stanford Business School, and she did take over the Lux Trek from me. So we initially bonded over that and a lot of common interests. It was a big leap of faith for us to work together because we had not known each other in a professional context. We had not worked together, but we did get to know each other over time. And I think what was really important was we had just developed a relationship and a friendship that was very authentic. We had a lot of shared values, and that came through. Actually, later on, as we discovered, we had very similar upbringings and childhoods. I think values come from a place that's pretty deep. And so it's very hard to develop certain things over time. It's actually rooted in childhood, upbringing, your parents' values, and all of that. And she and I both had a very similar level of intensity, I would say. So we had a great chemistry in working together. And I think the relationship is one that is super important, especially in the early days when it's really just the two of you and maybe one or two other folks on the team. You know, it was the two of us for about a year and a half working out of my garage and basement. And it's a very classic and humble Silicon Valley startup story in a way. And having that partner is helpful because it's emotionally really draining to go through a lot of ups and downs, to go through a lot of uncertainty. And so we really relied on each other from that perspective.
So moving a little bit into your business and Rev and the product, you've built a bag and a brand around the needs of the modern woman. And I can say that I really resonate with your target customer. I have many times wanted a fashionable bag to throw my makeup, my gym clothes, my laptop, whatever, into and run around town. But that's not practical. I've snapped a few straps on some bags and then have moved to something a little bit more practical, but it just doesn't feel like my personal identity or brand. The Maestra, however, one of your best-selling bags, is incredibly stylish, is made with luxurious leather, different colors that are so beautiful, has straps to make it a backpack. You can wear it however you want and still make a massive style statement. So what is your philosophy around product creation, and how has putting the SendRev woman at the center of product development differed from how luxury brands and retailers have traditionally thought about building for their customer?
First of all, I think it's really important to know that SendRev is really fundamentally centered around the evolving life, taste, habits, preferences of this modern millennial luxury shopper. It fundamentally, that underpins the brand. So I think that really changes everything. You know, it's not just about certain pieces of product development or certain messages of our marketing. It is a really core value that the brand and the company and I hold dear. And it's core to everything that we do. So I think that is fundamentally very different from how heritage or traditional luxury brands approach their brand. They don't really focus and center their brand around this woman, right? They really focus on the heritage, you know, the romantic dreams, which I think those are inspiring and important and have a place. Sense and Dream is about this balance, right? It's about this brand being able to bring these dichotomies together, you know, dichotomies of fantasy and everyday and beauty and design and elegance and luxury versus versatility and functionality and organization and all the things you talked about that you want out of a bag and that you need, you know, it's really more complex and it represents how the woman is becoming more complex. Her lifestyle is so multifaceted and there's not a single definition or a single hat that she wears, right? Oftentimes she's creative, she's an executive, she's a mother, she's a philanthropist, she's a daughter. You know, there's so many roles that women play today. I think what's really at the heart of SunRev is we are a brand that evolves with that woman.
Talk us through building the first bag. I can just imagine the iterations of products you had come to your doorstep where you're like, not this one, not this one. I'd love to get a bit of insight into how you actually nailed that first silhouette and materialization of the hero item in the SunRev collection.
I think it was a learning experience for me personally, because prior to starting SunRev, I worked at companies where the final product was data, or it was a presentation, or it was software. And so it's very different to be creating a physical, tangible product. And so really had to do a lot of research and really arm myself with knowledge and firsthand experience to be able to understand the ins and outs. Building a bag is actually a very technical process because it's unlike apparel, right? It's three-dimensional. There's something architectural about it. It's almost like building a house in a way. And so there are so many different elements. There are so many different things that could affect the outcome when, in fact, they're really little things. You know, for example, making decisions on how to turn the edges or the corners of the bag, that could impact whether or not it looks more luxurious and elevated or more flat and more mass market. So there's so many little nuances and details that I learned over time. I think the first critical turning point for me and for SunRev from a product perspective was being able to find a partner in Italy that was able to execute and deliver on the quality that I really felt was critical. You know, I had a certain level that I wanted to make sure we could achieve straight out of the gate with our first product. And we searched all over. I traveled to Asia, elsewhere in Europe, all over the US looking for manufacturer partners. And the factory that ended up partnering with us is this amazing multi-generational factory that's worked with all the leading luxury brands. And they just really nailed it. You know, they were able to bring this vision to life and execute it perfectly. So that was really critical. In terms of the process, you know, we had a really interesting design meets data approach. So it's always meant to be an artistic process. And that is really creative and it comes from a place of emotion. And that's what allows our products to inspire and create these emotional connections. But at the same time, it's complemented by data. And we interviewed and surveyed and did focus groups with so many women understanding their pain points, understanding what can be improved. What are the features that they're really missing? You know, to your point about being able to hold a laptop or staying organized or having straps that don't break, these were all things that came forward. But it's neither an purely artistic process, nor is it a purely data-driven, analytical, quantitative process. It's really the combination that makes the end result the perfect bag.
I can see why your time at Medallia was really valuable in building SunRev. You've built your first prototype of a bag, and so you have something to take to investors. SunRev is a venture-backed company today, and actually you've raised over $20 million from incredible investors such as Sonia Brown at Norwest Venture Partners and Jesse Draper at Halogen Ventures.
I made a very strong and clear decision early on that SunRev was going to be an ambitious business in the sense that I always thought of SunRev as a global brand, a global vision, a company and a brand that was going to disrupt how things were done in traditional luxury and traditional retail. With that level of ambition comes a level of capital that's required. And so in terms of finding the sources for that capital, I've always been really thoughtful about what is appropriate for what stage of the company, for what is the right fit for the needs of the company and what is going to allow the company to achieve its ultimate goals and who is the right partner to be on that rocket ship and who is that right partner who has the right long-term mindset such that as a company and especially as a premium and luxury brand, we're not making short-term decisions that will affect the long-term viability and status of the brand.
Who was that first check from that said, yes, I resonate with this need for a new luxury brand and I want to invest in you and Wendy?
You know, that's such a great question. No one has really asked me this before, and it's actually an amazing and hilarious and memorable story about our first check. So Wendy had interned at venture capital firm in LA called Anthos Capital, and they had a small office in Menlo Park that we camped out of for a little bit of time. So we were just doing different brainstorms there. This is very early days. There was a gentleman who is he's incredible. He's also a Stanford trustee and a huge important figure, I would say, in the Stanford community. But his name is Wally Holly. He just was so impressed by our dedication and our perseverance, and he really saw some of the ups and downs that we had in the early days. So when we started speaking to different investors, he was like, I want to be your first check. So he was our first check. We celebrated with big hugs all around, and it was quite a memorable and sweet experience. And he's amazing, and he's so supportive of entrepreneurs and the next generation of investors. He's just a really old school but incredible gentleman.
I love that because when you look at your cap table today, you have these powerhouse women who were advising you, but it was actually a man who's been in the industry for years who believed in you first. And I think that really resonates with the room and our listeners because it really is people from all different walks of life who can help to enable your dream. And so that is incredible to hear. That was your experience.
And it also just really speaks to the fact that when building a business, yes, you need to fundraise, and there's a lot of tactical aspects of it, but it is really about the people. And it's sometimes those little moments, especially early on, that make such a big difference at kind of putting fuel to the fire and creating a momentum and helping you push onwards, even in the face of times where there is ambiguity and uncertainty.
It's really important to surround yourself with believers, I would say, especially in the early days, because when you don't have traction, when you don't have data, when you don't have revenues, when you don't even have a product, all you really have is your vision, your optimism. It's really hard to constantly be fighting with naysayers and people who are doubters and people who are haters. And so having folks like Wally, they're such amazing people, you know, always encouraging. And he had tremendous success in his career. Just an incredible person who's met a lot of entrepreneurs and successful people throughout the year. And so for him to say, I believe in you, and for him to say, I want to put money behind it, is a huge source of confidence. And it was just really a boost of energy for us. So that was how the first check came about.
That's amazing. I love this thread of people having an impact on your business and Rev, because some people that you've probably never even met actually have helped to really bring Send Rev to notoriety. Some of your early growth was through social media posts from key executives like Emily White, the CEO of Snapchat, and then celebrities such as Selma Blair or Priyank Chopra, who found your bag and thought, I need this in my life. I'm going to wear this and use this. And it created a lot of early buzz. Walk us through some of these moments of growth related to social media and influencers.
It's really important to build a brand based on authenticity. And so for us in the early days, we really wanted to see this organic traction of, do women really love our products? Are they really using it? Are they talking about it and sharing it with their friends? And I remember one of the most amazing moments very early on, maybe a couple months after we launched, our friends were telling us, hey, I was at this women's private equity summit in Half Moon Bay, and three of the panelists, you know, three of the five panelists had SunRev bags. Oh my gosh. That was an example of really exciting moment. A few months later, a friend texted me and was like, hey, I'm on a business class flight from SFO to Sao Paulo, and there are two women with SunRev bags. Oh my gosh. These moments kept happening, which was just incredible and was an indication of, yes, that organic love and demand for our products was there. There was clear product market fit. And with regards to social media, it just really amplified that organic and authentic love for the product and the brand.
You're touching on something really important, I think, to the modern brand, which is having a meaning behind what you're building. And this is what you mentioned, authenticity, and having SunRev mean something. Especially the future generation cares about this when they're purchasing their clothes. Not only do they care about what you stand for, they care about how you're impacting the planet. So I'm curious, because today, you know, your shopper is Claudia and I, is businesswomen, but the future of SunRev is Gen Z, the people who are pioneering sustainable re-commerce. And so how does SunRev think about leaning into those consumers?
Sustainability has always been a big pillar of SunRev. We actually are very much built on this concept of zero waste, which is something that we feel really, really strongly about. So one of the biggest challenges with fashion and historically what has happened is overproduction of products and creating a ton of waste. I would say that's the number one thing that really damages the world and the environment. And it's really frustrating and even somewhat offensive to me, knowing what I know about the process of creating product, especially at this premium and handcrafted luxury level, to see brands like Burberry or Louis Vuitton burn millions of dollars worth of products, right? And this is something that has been talked about on the New York Times, has been reported on, that a lot of consumers previously were not aware about.
Burn bags? What do you mean?
And clothing and just millions of dollars of merchandise because they overproduced. And so not only is it offensive that they're literally burning it and creating carbon dioxide into the world in terms of how they destroy the product, but it's also really offensive because this is product that a artisan handcrafted that I have seen firsthand in terms of the blood, sweat, and tears that goes and the passion that goes into creating a beautiful product like this, just totally destroyed and disrespected. The first tenet for us from a product perspective is that we really focus on zero waste. And so we have had some challenges with that because we have a lean supply chain. We don't hold on to a lot of inventory. So in our first year of launch, I don't know if I've ever shared this publicly, but we actually sold out about 6 months into our launch. So we had no product. So we launched in late November, right? And so we had no product starting in June. Thankfully, our community was so patient with pre-orders and wait lists and all of this. But we've always just managed inventory very lightly, more just in time. We've sold everything we've ever produced. We're extremely proud of that. But as a result, you know, our community needs to be more patient with us, right? Especially, for example, during COVID this year, we had a really challenging time when our factory in Italy shut down for 2.5 months. And as a result, we ran really behind from a supply chain perspective. And it took a lot of patience and a lot of explaining and a lot of empathy and understanding from our community to be okay with that. But we've gotten through that and they've reopened. But it's really a business decision that we made very early on that we were not going to ever overproduce. That is a huge aspect and pillar of our sustainability mindset. The second thing is we also think about doing things that are ethical and moral, and we want to make sure that people who work on the products are paid fair wages, that have a safe working environment. That's also really important to us. So we've done a lot of visits and audits and tours, me firsthand at our factory, understanding the situation there and understanding that it is a friendly environment for all of the artisans who create our products.
When you sell all of your inventory in 6 months, that is probably the strongest testament to the fact that consumers are demanding your product. And you sold out in the US, but I think to some of your more recent strategy, the world is demanding your product. We know that you've hired a new head of growth, Mark Chow, and you're really pursuing the Asian market. You opened a store in Pacific Place in Hong Kong, which for folks who are not familiar with Pacific Place is probably the beacon of luxury and consumer culture in Asia. I was there last summer and it was incredible because it's one of these malls where you basically take all of the luxury brands from Europe, put them in one destination. There is floor-to-ceiling glass and tunnels, and it's really, I think, a symbol of being an established global brand. So tell us a little bit more about how you think about your product and your target customer as you expand to Asia. We know that you've launched a new style for petite frames. I know that the Asian customer, especially in China, they're always demanding smaller bags. And so I think that's something that's interesting about how the product is different. How do you think about this new customer and your product line?
It's been a tremendous, tremendous success for us in terms of our Asia growth this year, especially. I think to your point, having a physical presence in a place like Pacific Place is so representative of how far this brand has come. Not sure if you're aware, but they're extremely selective of brands. And it was actually quite a long vetting and interview process for us to be able to have the location, which is in the middle, it's the best location within that entire shopping center complex. And they were incredibly impressed with the execution that the team did and also with the level of interest and traffic that we generated. We had about 10,000 people come to the pop-up during the summer, which is incredible. And it's during a time of COVID and all of these macro challenges. So we just felt that it was so successful. And again, to your point, an indication of how that market is really ready and excited to embrace Senrev as a brand. In terms of the products, we did launch an exclusive bag called the Aluna. And the way that I like to describe it, it's a sister bag to the Maestra family because it has a similar face, but a much slimmer profile. And to your point, a better fit for more petite frames, but it still has all the organization and versatility of the Maestra family. You can wear it in multiple ways as a backpack, as a crossbody. And so women really, really love that bag. I think what we've also seen that's been really interesting is there's a lot of offline to online relationships. So as with our pop-up and brick-and-mortar presence, we've also seen our online presence flourish with the APAC market. So we actually also launched on Tmall during that time. And currently we have a pop-up at the Kerry Center in Shanghai, which is a similar level of presence in terms of luxury as Pacific Place. And that's been incredibly successful as well.
I'm really excited to see how the brand continues to grow in these new markets. Just as we're kind of wrapping up, we've chatted a lot about the growth and future of Senrev, but would love to touch a little bit on about what's next for you, Coral. In the past, you've spoken about how motherhood has been such a driving force for you as a woman and as a founder. And so would love to know how you integrate those two roles in your life.
I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I grapple with every single day. I love my daughter. She's wonderful. But 2020 has really thrown us for a loop because she is, you know, an incredible 7-year-old who's very independent. And normally when she's going to school, it's a very different relationship than when she's studying at home and taking classes virtually. And so we've really had to be very adaptable. So on the one hand, it's been incredible to have more time with her because typically I travel so much to Italy, to Asia, to New York, pretty much all over. And so obviously with COVID, we have all been quarantined and grounded and have not traveled. So in a way, it's really precious and nice to be able to spend time with her uninterrupted by travel. But of course, on the other hand, being a mother, a teacher, a enforcer of rules all the time, and it's just challenging in so many ways, especially because during the day, even though I am here, I am on Zoom calls and Google multiple hangouts and really back to back until the evening. One thing that I really did do, and a recent teammate who just joined my team actually complimented for this, and I didn't realize it was so significant, but he said, you know, you're the first manager, CEO, executive that I've worked with who actually specifically blocks time on her calendar for her daughter. And I have a block of time from 6:30 to 8:30 every evening during the week that is on my calendar, and it's called Aria time, and that's my daughter's name. So it is a sacred time, you know, because even though I'm not traveling during the other times during the day, I'm not available to her. I want to be 100% present for her and tuck her in and put her down and read to her before bedtime and have those really treasured moments and routines. One of the things that has been really also critical for me is having a lot of discussion with my partner, with my husband, about, you know, what does it mean to be in a 50-50 marriage, and how does that impact, you know, who is the quarterback of the day for our daughter, for example. And so my husband, to his credit, actually wrote this whole manifesto during this height of COVID, laying out, you know, what does it mean to be a quarterback? What days should, you know, Coral? So I quarterback Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and my husband quarterbacks Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and we trade off, and we have a morning meeting that kicks off kind of the family schedule of the day.
This is epic. I think Claudia and I are taking copious notes. Neither of us are at the stage of life where we have children, but it is, I think, in both of our futures, hopefully, but it's great to hear that you found a life partner and built a family structure not too dissimilar from your work life in terms of having organization principles and systems in place for helping your daughter feel loved and supported, but also still keep the trains running on time.
I love the idea of like a daily family sprint planning. I think that is incredible.
And we'd love to ask you one closing question, which speaks to the other mentors you have had in your life. And it is, who has been a woman specifically in your life that has really had a profound impact on you and your journey?
I think we mentioned, I mentioned to you last time that there are so many to choose from. And so one of the women who I just really love, I had her as a professor at Stanford, and she's always been so inspiring to me, is Condi Rice. And she is just one of those women who's so poised and stylish, but also funny and witty and not so serious. And given her incredible career and all the breakthroughs that she's had, you know, as an academic, in politics, in business, it's just, she's a Renaissance woman. And she's also an incredible musician and pianist. So I have so much admiration for her and all that she's achieved. And I think she just is a constant source of inspiration to me. And I think it's been a real privilege to be able to meet her and get to know her on a level that's quite personal. And being able to have her as a professor, I think, was really profound and tremendously inspirational for me.
Thank you so much, Coral, for joining us today on The Room. All your stories have really brightened up our day, and I think will inspire our listeners to know that there are all types of venture businesses out there that you can build, including disrupting a hundreds of year old luxury brand market. So thank you again for being here and talking to us about your vision for the future of luxury fashion.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Room. If you enjoyed our conversation, please like and subscribe. Stay tuned for next week's inspiring guest, airing Tuesdays at 7 a.m. Pacific. See you soon.
All opinions expressed by Claudia and Madison and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of the 5EC. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.